Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Crinoid Podcast number 15, Attack of the Cybermen. I have with me at the other end of a Skype line my partner in crime, Martin.
Hello, Jim.
I call him my partner in crime, but I think it's worth pointing out we don't get involved in criminal activity of any sort.
No, of course we don't.
Well, now that's out of the way. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Just back from a bank job. Oh, sorry, I wasn't supposed to say that.
Shh. Yes, ready for Christmas?
Yes. Yourself?
Yes, I'm full of mince pies.
Yeah, you're always full of mince pies, regardless of the time of year.
Yes, I like mince.
You certainly mince around a lot.
Thank you kindly.
No problem.
Yes, but on with the blind unreasoning fury. Attack of the Cybermen today. Mm. First broadcast in January 1985, filmed around May of the previous year. It broadcast for the first time in two 45-minute long weekly parts back on Saturdays.
Not for the first time.
Eh?
Resurrection of the Daleks was shown in two 45-minute parts.
Yeah, not originally, though.
Yes, originally, yes.
Was it?
It was.
One out of the series was done like that and the rest weren't.
Correct. I can't remember the reason.
Was it during a World Cup or something?
It was something like that. There was definitely a reason why they did it. And it was just a one-off thing. And it kind of became the template for the following year, yeah, that they went to the 45-minute format.
Yes, it was broadcast on two consecutive Saturdays, beginning of January, in 45-minute parts. It's a little bit of a mystery about who actually wrote it. It looks like it was Paula Woolsey and the script editor at the time, Eric Saward. The pseudonym given to the writer is Paula Moore.
On the DVD, there's an interview with Eric Saward as part of the making of documentary on there, which he seems to suggest that he basically wrote the whole thing, but because he wasn't allowed to. They had to find a pseudonym for it.
Oh.
Also, there's Ian Levine, the so-called superfan, had some input, apparently, although he seems to feel that he wrote some of the dialogue, whereas Eric Sarad doesn't have the same opinion.
Mm, interesting.
So an interesting kind of history to it, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think it's people being ashamed of it and not wanting to say that they've got involved. I think there does seem to be some genuine, committee way of writing this one. But anyway, more of that later, really, I think. It had a working title of Return of the Cybermen, which is rather feeble, and The Cold War, and eventually, of course, landed with Attack of the Cybermen, which is fairly feeble, too, in my opinion. But there you go. This was during the John Nathan Turner era. Of course, it was the first story of Colin Baker's first full season. So it had the mighty Twin Dilemma, and this was the second time that viewers got to see Colin Baker in action, really, in a full story. Episode 1, we start with two workmen in a London sewer underneath Fleet Street, doing some surveying, I guess. One of them makes a joke that there are more bulges down there than an antenatal clinic. His colleague finds what seems to be a fairly freshly built brick wall where there shouldn't be one, according to the plans.
One of them goes off to kind of check where they are, and the other one shines his torch on the wall, and there's kind of a reference number on the wall which confirms where they are, you know, they're in the correct place. And he calls out to his mate, David, but who doesn't respond. So he goes to look for him, and he's attacked by something and apparently killed. I thought that was really really good opening, actually, and it was very reminiscent of Earthshock, the music,
yes.
the whole feel of it, really, sort of, I thought it was very well shot. It was just reminiscent of those sort of scenes down underground with those androids where they were killing everybody.
Yeah, yeah, it's good to see. But I think it's, they do a point of view shot, don't they, from whatever the creature is that's killing this worker. It's, I think, a little bit over-pixelated, and you can't really see what's happening. But there does appear to be a sort of a black, shiny arm involved. But, yeah, I mean, it's got a very arresting beginning, isn't it?
Mm.
The sewers, I think, look a little bit too clean. Other than that, I think it's a good scene.
Well, would you rather they were slopping around in excrement, would you?
Yes, I'd like to have seen audio smeared over the walls, but, you know, you can't have everything.
No, you can't. Anyway, next scene we get is the Doctor, who is inside the TARDIS repairing something. He's got one of the roundels off the wall, hasn't he? And he's using a sonic lance to mess around with it. Something explodes, and Perry comes running in with an apple in her hand.
And a couple of melons up her shirt.
I should say at this point that Perry does a lot of running around for no other reason than to make those melons move up and down, really, doesn't she?
I think that's absolutely true, yes. Still, never mind, eh?
Yeah. One of the highlights of this story, I think.
Yes, it turns out the Doctor is repairing the famed chameleon circuit in the TARDIS, which is, as we all know, the circuit that's supposed to make the exterior of the TARDIS blend into whatever surroundings it meets when it lands.
Mm.
That, of course, hasn't worked since 1963. But because of, you know, the explosion and the Doctor's general sort of erratic behaviour, Perry's worried that he's doing a bit too much and is perhaps not quite through his early regeneration problems and is a bit unstable, which, of course, causes Colin Baker to do his usual say everything three times, getting louder each time. Unstable! But there's a nice bit in that scene where he takes a bite of Perry's apple and gives it back to unexpectedly.
The Doctor suggests that they both need a rest. They should try and find somewhere nice to go. Starts to work around the console, flicking a few switches, and then it all goes a bit pear-shaped, doesn't it? And you get that wobbly effect that they were keen on during this era, but they used it quite a lot in Resurrection of the Daleks and other stories. And they kind of both grab onto the console and start talking in funny voices.
Yes, their vocals get kind of slowed down a lot, don't they?
Yeah.
Quite a good moment. Then we're back in London on the surface this time, and we see a familiar figure. It is Lytton, who we saw in the previous season, Resurrection of the Daleks. And he's now leading what seems to be a small gang of criminals who are planning some kind of diamond heist. Apparently there's £10 million pounds worth of ice, I believe they call it, in the criminal fraternity, in this building.
And, tasty. Very tasty.
Very tasty. although it appeared to be, the others thought, just a bit of a recce, Lytton decides that there's a change of plan and they're going to do the job today. So one of these criminal characters, Russell, played by Terry Molloy, who is Davros Mark III, also seen in Resurrection of the Daleks, is sent off to get 7 kilos of plastic. Plastic explosives, not Tupperware.
And as he goes, Lytton turns to the other two and he says, I think they question whether they can trust him. And he says, if he fails, Payne's going to kill him. These other two, there's Payne and Griffiths, isn't there?
Yeah.
But yeah, as they pull up, in the start of this scene, they pull up in a Ford Cortina, don't they? And you get the kind of the Lytton theme, which is recurring music. I quite like it.
Oh, you see, that's interesting because I don't like it.
Don't you?
But I do like all these scenes with the criminal bunch, you know, some outtake from the Sweeney. But I think that the incidental music, it's Malcolm Clarke, isn't it? I think the incidental music is just a little bit annoying in these particular scenes.
Mm. I think it's hit and miss throughout the story, the music. Some of it's quite good and some of it's painful, as we'll come to.
A trifle intrusive.
We then see Russell in a phone booth, don't we? And he's calling somebody, telling them that the job's today, and asking for this 7 kilos of plastic and make sure they have it ready.
So, yeah, it looks like there's a bit of double crossing is going on there.
Mm.
Yes, back in the TARDIS console room, The Doctor is pleased to announce that the TARDIS is undamaged from whatever happened at the end of the last scene there. And then, unfortunately, there's, I think, a bit of padding here. This is fairly kind of boring chat about the Doctor not being able to pilot the TARDIS properly, which after a while gets a bit tedious, doesn't it?
Mm.
And then they see on the TARDIS monitor a rather unconvincing Halley's Comet heading towards Earth. So the Doctor deduces from that, it's got about a 75-year cycle, isn't it, visiting the Earth, deduces that it's 1985 on Earth.
That's right. You get some kind of unpleasantness, really, between the Doctor and Perry, don't you, building on the earlier scene where they just don't seem to like each other. You know, as we said before in the Varos podcast when we did that, you do wonder why they travel together at times.
You do, yeah. I mean, there's a bit of a hangover from Twin Dilemma, isn't it, the previous story at the end of the previous season, where at one point the Doctor actually tries to kill Perry, doesn't he, because of his dodgy regeneration. And she clearly doesn't trust him yet since all that. But you'd think she'd leave at the earliest opportunity after that, wouldn't you?
Mm. Yeah.
But it doesn't... it grates a little bit for the viewer, I think, all this constant bickering in the TARDIS.
I think it does, yeah. Anyway, Lytton, Payne and Griffiths arrive at these garages and they kind of go inside. I think Griffiths queries what they're doing there and then says that they're not going to go in guns blazing with nylon stockings over their heads. At which point Payne says about Griffiths, oh, he's allergic to nylon. Which I think is great. Because there's a little bit of kind of banter between the two of them, isn't there, throughout.
Yeah, and it's not very good natured, is it, either? Most of it. They seem to have a little bit of history, don't they, those two?
Yeah. Anyway, they uncover an entrance down to the sewers, and Lytton says that they're going to blow their way in from below. Griffiths is worried about them setting off the alarms, and that the old bill will be down on them. But Lytton says that, you know, the alarms will go off all over the area and the police won't know where to start looking for them. Which is, yeah, quite a good idea.
Yeah, yeah, well, he's no mug, is he, Lytton? Back in the TARDIS console room, just a quick scene of Perry being worried about the reputation of Halley's Comet as being a sign of impending doom. And then there's sort of various padding around that, isn't there?
Yeah. And then we see Lytton back at these garages, and he opens his cabinet, and there's some sort of futuristic controls inside, isn't there? And he kind of adjusts something, and kind of hear the signal start. Payne tells Griffiths to lose the motor.
all very Sweeney, isn't it?
Yeah, and then he shows him, takes him into the garages. As they go in, two policemen appear over the other side of the road watching them. And for those kind of regular viewers would probably have remembered them as the two policemen that used to hang around with Lytton in Resurrection of the Daleks. For the casual viewer, they'd have probably thought, oh, look, the police know where they are.
Yeah, so it's an interesting one, isn't it? That kind of two layers there. Interesting, it's exactly the same actors who are in Resurrection of the Daleks as well. They managed to get hold of the same two actors.
Yeah.
So a nice bit of continuity. So basically, yeah, the gang is all together there. Griffiths, Payne, Russell and Lytton. So they're all ready to go, really. Back on the TARDIS, both Perry and the Doctor notice a distress signal, which appears to be coming from Earth in 1985, which is kind of unlikely and not very desirable. And the Doctor decides they should land and investigate.
Mm. Lytton, meanwhile, is screwing a silencer onto a gun, which Russell doesn't like, and nor does Griffiths. He sort of says it's obscene, doesn't he? And Lytton's annoyed about this, and he blames Griffiths for starting some dissent. I think Griffiths says he doesn't like all this secrecy. Lytton says, well, he doesn't tell him anything because he's new to the group. He doesn't tell the other two anything because they're muscle heads who wouldn't understand it anyway. And Griffiths is like, you got a rough tongue, Mr. Lytton. He goes, well, you better learn to live with it because, you know, your takings have never been as good as when you've been working for me. And if you make too much of a fuss, you're out.
Yeah. So there's a fair amount of dissent in the ranks, and no one really, perhaps the exception of Payne, are that keen on being there, are they? Griffiths and Russell don't appear to be that willing. It turns out that Russell is new to the group, which has become significant a little later on. Mm. Payne is sent down into the pit with a sledgehammer, isn't he, to start getting the bricks out of the way so they can get to the sewers. So they can, you know, get on with blowing the foundations of this this building with the diamonds in. And Payne says about the sledgehammer, he used to use one when he worked for the council. Lytton, in one of his many put-downs, says this time it's for swinging, not leaning on.
Yeah, good line. Then we get the TARDIS landing in a junkyard, don't we? And it's overlaid by this rubbish music.
This looks familiar.
It's kind of a play on the Steptoe and Son theme, isn't it, really?
Yeah, incidentally, composed by Ron Grainer, as the Doctor Who theme was.
Yeah, but I found that a bit cringeworthy.
It was extremely cringeworthy.
And the Doctor comes out holding this sort of tracking device, and looks around and says, "This looks familiar." Perry follows him out, and they start to walk off. She mentions that the TARDIS hasn't changed. He's supposedly fixed the chameleon circuit, but nothing's happened. And he says he's probably thinking about it. And as they start to walk off, it changes. Unfortunately, Perry turns around already laughing before it's happened, doesn't she?
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah. It turns out that, you know, the joke is that the TARDIS has changed, but into a strange, I suppose it's some kind of ornate dresser, is it? It's a piece of furniture with, strangely painted piece of furniture, which is just as incongruous in the junkyard as the police box was.
Mm.
But yeah, you're right. Perry's just smiling about that before she's even seen it.
Back in the sewers, Griffiths asks how far they got to go. And Lytton says, "Oh, it's about a mile." And he goes, "A mile in these boots?" And Payne says, "What, are you allergic to walking as well?" Apparently his boots don't fit him, which is why he's...
he starts complaining about the smell as well, doesn't he?
Yeah. The Doctor says he feels a bit conspicuous wandering around the streets. Perry says, "I'm not surprised in that coat." But then she starts sort of questioning his memory because he keeps referring to her as Tegan, Zoe, Susan and Jamie.
that's quite a mistake, isn't it?
Yeah.
For Jamie.
Well, you know, Jamie wore a skirt, didn't he? So. And also he called her Zodin, apparently. When she tells him that, he thinks, well, maybe there is something up with mind after all.
Yes, the terrible Zodin is, as you remember from our Five Doctors podcast, was never seen on screen, is she, but mentioned in the Five Doctors first.
Mm.
The Doctor seems to have found the source of the distress signal.
Mm.
After a bit of toing and froing around the streets.
And some more gratuitous running around from Perry.
Yes, for the dads, for the phrases. But this building that they find this, it seems to be the source of it, it seems to be unoccupied. And then the Doctor suddenly has a brainwave and says, "I'm a fool, that's precisely what I would have done." And he runs back the way that they came. So Perry has to run behind him, of course.
Mm.
And at this point we see those... Lytton's two policemen silently stalking them.
Yes. Back in the sewers, Griffiths thinks that they're being followed by something. Lytton sends Payne back to deal with whoever it is, and he gives him a gun, doesn't he? Meanwhile, the Doctor stops at the sign to the junkyard, and it's the I am Foreman sign, and he sort of turns to Perry and says, "Look, Susan." Obviously, this is a reference back to the very first story back in 1963. He's got kind of a wistful look on his face, I think, as he's looking at it. Then anyway, they head back to the TARDIS, again watched by the policeman, and they dematerialise.
It's interesting in the way they get into the TARDIS, don't they, which is this big dresser. They can't find the way in to start with, can they? But conveniently, for the production team, the door is at the back, and therefore completely out of shot, so they just walk behind it and go in without any access being required into this piece of furniture.
Mm. Inside the TARDIS, the Doctor tells Perry why he's run back there and that basically the signal had been bounced around various points so that whoever it is that's setting the signal off could avoid detection. And then between them, they realised that the place must have been watched, otherwise whoever it was wouldn't know that they'd been found. And you get a quick scene of the policeman arriving at the garages where the others had gone down into the sewers.
The Doctor is in the console room. He's trying to locate the alien, and Perry's a little bit worried about whether the alien would be pleased to see them, but the Doctor quite confidently says, oh, he's probably all of a dither, waiting for us to arrive.
Down in the sewers, Payne is attacked and killed, isn't he, by the same thing that got the sewer worker earlier. Again, we see this black arm, don't we?
Interestingly, those scenes in the sewers are very, very dark, aren't they? Which is quite atmospheric, but much darker than you'd expect things to be filmed in very, very low levels of light. It works very well. The TARDIS is now a pipe organ. It materialises at Lytton's garage. The Doctor and Perry come out of the back, of course, and the Doctor goes over to the keyboard and plays a bit of Bach, Toccata and Fugue in D minor. Quite nicely, the incidental music carries on the piece after the Doctor's finished playing and they wander off and have a look round.
Mm.
Colin Baker has a nice piece of business, doesn't he? He looks like he's going to fall into this inspection pit, but actually just steps over it without actually looking where he's going, much to Perry's alarm. And he finds the filing cabinet in the garage, which contains that alien tech that we saw Lytton using earlier on. Unfortunately, there's the usual plot device of the Doctor ignoring his companion, isn't there, at this point when Perry's trying to get his attention because a policeman has popped his head out of the pit and is pointing a gun at her.
That's right. The Doctor manages to kick the gun out of his hand, though, doesn't he? And then he kind of treads on his head, pushing him down into the hole, and he jumps in after him. And we hear the sounds of a tussle going on down there, don't we? Meanwhile, the second policeman has arrived and he's pointing his gun at Perry, but she sort of picks up some brick dust from behind her and throws it in his eyes. So he drops the gun and she picks it up. The Doctor pops his head out of the hole wearing the policeman's helmet, doesn't he? Which Perry's kind of turns towards him with the gun and then sees it's him. And there's a real go at him, doesn't she? He says she could have killed him.
But it's an interesting line, a nice line from the Doctor, when Perry asks where the other policeman is, and the Doctor says, oh, he's having a little lie down.
Mm.
He's obviously administered a leathering down there in a pit.
Yeah, so the Doctor takes the handcuffs from the policeman and handcuffs him to a sort of a metal piece of equipment nearby, doesn't he? And then asks him for the key, takes that away. And then the Doctor and Perry head down into the sewers.
Yeah, Perry takes the gun, doesn't she? But there's a little production issue here. It's Nicola Bryant's shorts were too short for her to put the gun and silencer in her pocket. So she, we see her unscrewing the silencer and leaving it behind and then putting the unsilenced gun into her pocket.
Mm. Yes.
Is that a gun in her pocket or is she just pleased to see the Doctor? That doesn't really work that way around, does it?
Not really, no.
Moving on.
She could have popped it down a cleavage, surely.
Plenty of room there.
Anyway, down in the sewers, Lytton, Griffiths and Russell are getting a bit worried about Payne because he's not come back. Lytton says, oh, you know, it'll be right, he'll catch us up, and tells Griffiths to start knocking the wall down. Griffiths notices again that the wall seems to be in the wrong place, but they confirm where they are again by shining the light, and it's obviously the same place where the sewer men were killed earlier. The Doctor and Perry, meanwhile, are now down in the sewers, and they start to have a look around, and we see the black arm again, don't we, watching them. Well, it's not the arm that's watching them, I guess, but you know what I mean.
Well, you don't know how alien the thing is.
Yes, it's an arm with eyes.
Yeah, at this point, Griffiths begins to start knocking this wall down, or rather tapping it by the sound of it.
Yeah.
Some rather feeble taps. The others see a dark figure in the distance in the tunnel, and they wonder if it's Payne coming back to rejoin the group. It isn't. As it becomes closer, it's clear to them, well, clear to us that it's a Cyberman, and clear to them that it isn't Payne. Griffiths starts shooting at it. Russell runs off. One of Griffiths' shots appears to wound it. The Cyberman theme is playing, in case anyone had noticed that it was a Cyberman.
Sorry, when it's hit, you see the sort of green fluid squirt out then.
Yeah, John Nathan Turner, styly. Mm. Green fluid squirt out of everything, didn't it, during his reign?
Fantastic.
Yes. But Lytton stops Griffiths shooting at him, and he seems to shout over, I think, but logically it should be open, shouldn't it? What did you think?
Yeah, I replayed that a few times to figure out what you said. I couldn't really decide what it was, to be honest. I don't think it doesn't sound like open, but that would make the most sense.
Yeah.
It could be over, as you know, sort of suggesting get over there kind of thing, but I don't know.
But anyway, the new wall that has been puzzling everybody slides back to reveal a group of Cybermen.
Mm, quite effective, I thought, that bit.
Yeah, it's great.
Anyway, Lytton introduces himself, doesn't he, and says he is the Cyber Leader's prisoner and hands over his gun, which the Cyber Leader promptly snaps in half, although it looked as if it was already broken, didn't it?
Maybe it was a second or third take.
Yeah, Griffiths turns to run away and there's a Cyberman standing right behind him, and isn't it? And he just sort of screams into its face.
Yeah, it's a nice bit, isn't it? Mm. The Doctor and Perry further back in the sewers hear the gunfire and Griffiths scream and run to help. On the way, they find Payne's body, and the Doctor says his neck's been broken. Mm. Perry thinks that they should get the real police involved. The Doctor kind of plays along, but clearly isn't really that interested in getting them involved. Right. And seems to be just investigating the situation for himself.
That's right. He says they need more hard evidence.
Yeah.
They've got a dead body. What more do they need? In the Cybermen's base, behind this brick wall, along one wall you see a couple of people that are being converted into Cybermen. One of Lytton's policemen. And then you see one of the sewer workers as well, don't you? Mm. The Cyber Leader is talking to Lytton and Griffiths, and he's asking them how they managed to find them. Lytton says that he's been tracking their transmissions from the ship on the far side of the moon, and the Cyber Leader seems a bit worried about this, and he starts to tell one of his subordinates to increase the distortion or something. But Lytton sort of says the Earth authorities won't be able to find them because they haven't got the technology. And this is where you find out where he's from. Lytton says he's not from Earth, he's from Vita 15, and the Cyber Leader says, what satellite are you, is that? And he says, Riften 5. I think one of the Cybermen says that people from there are a race of warriors who fight only for money, and so, you know, Lytton should not be trusted. Lytton says that he's willing to serve the Cybermen, but only as himself. He doesn't want to be converted, obviously. And that he's brought the others with him as gifts for the Cybermen. And the Cyber Leader seems to think that this makes sense, so, you know, he's not going to kill him just yet. Lytton asks, what are you going to do with us? And he says, well, the Cyber Controller can decide your fate, and he is on the planet Telos.
Yeah, so the Cyber Controller and Telos were last seen, weren't they, in 1967 in Tomb of the Cybermen.
That's right.
So there's a bit of continuity for the long-term fan there. Interesting that we get to the bottom of what this black arm was, don't it? Because one of the Cybermen is blacked out, isn't he? Rather than being silver, he's sort of kind of a matte black. Mm. So good to see the Cybermen have embraced multi-ethnicity. Ethnicity, is it? Mm, yeah.
Easy for you to say.
But that is about the only redesign, isn't it, since the Five Doctors. I think they're boots look slightly different in this one, but I thought at the time, disappointingly, that I'm always quite interested to see how the Cybermen are different each time, and since Earthshock they haven't really changed that much, have they?
No, they hadn't. But yeah, it was nice to see these black Cybermen, if you like. Mm. They're stealth Cybermen, aren't they?
Yeah, creeping through sewers and stuff is ideal, really. I don't know if they're visible on radar or not.
Who knows?
But with the mention of Telos, we get a slightly unconvincing shot of the planet Telos hanging in the heavens. But then a superb shot down into a quarry with a cyber sentry standing in the foreground, which looks really good, doesn't it? It's surface of Telos. It's filmed in a huge sandpit in Gerard's Cross, previously used as a surface of Gioconda in the Twin Dilemma, the previous story. Mm. The production problem here was that they filmed The Twin Dilemma there in February and decided to come back to use the location for Telos. But they got there in May, and this time there was foliage everywhere rather than just all this sand and gravel. So they spent ages trying to get rid of all this foliage before they could start filming. But this time they got some excavators in and, did some kind of landscaping to give a kind of more striking, undulating landscape to the planet. And it looks really good, I think.
Yeah.
There are various pipes and stuff coming out of the ground and, several people working under cyber supervision. And an interesting point here is that originally there weren't going to be any scenes on the surface of Telos like this one. They got some extra film allocation for the story, so they included them. And for me, these are some of the best scenes in the story.
Yeah, I think so. I think these scenes and the scenes in the sewers are really make the story.
Yeah, it's great. They use a similar optical filter that they used in The Curse of Fenric, as we mentioned a few podcasts ago, to make it look like there's mist. There is some dry ice being pumped about, but a lot of it's just kind of overlaid over film. They also seem to have bleached some of the colour out of the picture, don't they? Because if you look at the publicity shots on location, the sand and gravel is quite orangey, isn't it? Whereas it's quite sort of grey and bleak looking as broadcast, yeah. So I think they've done a really, really good job on the surface of Telos here.
Mm. So, yeah, there's these men, they're working, what are they doing? They're kind of, I don't know, really.
Well, it turns out they're fixing explosives into the surface of the planet, aren't they?
Yeah.
So you see them kind of winding, sort of, they're kind of screwing these explosives in, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, they're working on the surface, supervised by these Cybermen. But clearly, a couple of them seem to have some sort of plan that they're about to put into action, because they're kind of looking around and then nodding at each other. And at a certain point, they spring into action. One of them knocks a Cyberman's head off with this kind of metal pole that he's got in his hand. Another one pushes one of the Cybermen over. And the third man is shot by one of the Cybermen on the top of the rise. The first man, who turns out to be called Bates, shouts to the other one to grab the head. But he kind of dithers, doesn't he, as the decapitated Cyberman kind of moves towards him. The head is actually shot and explodes by, you know, one of the Cybermen shoots at them and hits the head. And obviously destroys it. So the two men run off, leaving the others all still working.
There's a lovely bit, isn't it? Just as they run off, they're getting to the top of this sort of hill as they're escaping. And there's one worker just standing there carrying on doing his job. And they just push him over.
Yeah.
Entirely unnecessarily.
Exactly.
But it's good fun. It's a good scene, that, isn't it?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah.
It's kind of action-packed. Back in the sewers, Dr. Perry is sort of milling about. And then Russell appears, holds a knife to the doctor's throat. Apparently, the... Another production point. Apparently, the assistant floor manager told the actor Terry Molloy, who was playing Russell, to hold the knife further up Baker's chin. At which point Baker stared into the camera and joked, "All right, who said which one?" Which is nice. So Perry drops a gun when she sees that Russell's got a knife to the doctor. Russell searches the doctor and finds Payne's gun. The doctor says, "Oh, I found it." And Russell, quite nice, says, "Oh, yes, I wasn't aware it was lost." but the doctor kind of hints that Payne is dead, and then Russell gets very angry, doesn't he?
Mm.
Kind of sticks him against the wall.
Talking of angry, you haven't heard anything yet. Bates and Stratton, who are the two men that just escaped from the Cybermen on Telos, they have a bit of a set too, don't they? Bates really has a go at Stratton for not picking up the head.
We're safe. Safe? It was a shambles.
We got away?
Two of us? How many times am I going to tell you? It takes three to fly the ship. When are you going to get that fat in your thick head?
No, it's not the time or place to argue.
Argue, I can kill you! Why didn't you grab the head?
I panicked!
It's Stratton. Without that head and the third member, we are as much prisoners on Telos as if we stayed in the work party!
Apparently that they need three people to fly the ship he refers to, which we'll find out a bit later, a bit more about. But they also need the cyber head. And of course he didn't get it. And he says, you know, sorry, I panicked. There's some absolutely fantastic shouting from Bates, isn't there?
Yeah, he's really good throughout, isn't he, Bates? back down at the cyber base in the sewers, Lytton and Griffiths are kind of standing in the corner with their hands up, I think, aren't they? And Griffiths can't understand how Lytton knew all the stuff that he was saying to the cyber leader. And Lytton says, well, perhaps it's true. And then Griffiths says, you said you came from Fulham. And then Lytton goes to a fantastic insult about how he can't understand why his Griffith's ancestors bothered to pull themselves out of the primordial slime.
Yeah, fantastic line. We find a bit more from Stratton and Bates about what the Cybermen are up to. As you mentioned earlier, they're mining the planet with high explosives. Bates points out that when they leave, they're going to destroy the surface of the planet and obviously the workers with it. He says, well, you know, at least we're safe. He goes, safe? Safe? Because they know exactly where we're going. And he says, cyber control, and points to this building in the distance, which is cyber control, which looks a bit rubbish, really.
Oh, I thought it was quite good. It's a model, isn't it? Suspended quite close to the camera, so it looks like it's a kind of forced perspective. It looks like it's in the distance because of the way it's being sort of positioned, but it's actually closer to the camera than the actors are. Yeah. I thought it looked pretty good, actually.
Yeah, it's okay. I was a bit harsh.
But there's an interesting, another production point here. If you listen very carefully to the scene, you can actually hear birdsong, because you wouldn't get on Telos. And, you know, this is getting on for summer, so, you know, the birds were in full song, and Malcolm Clark had to write some incidental music to kind of mask this bird song, but it doesn't succeed completely.
So, yes, they point to cyber control, and then we immediately switch to cyber control inside, where the story takes a turn for the worse.
I'd have to agree with that.
There's a Cyberman, and he's telling the Cyber Controller that Stratton and Bates have escaped. The Cyber Controller is a big fat man in a cyber suit who seems to want to walk like a robot as opposed to like a Cyberman. And and the way he talks, you can hardly understand a word anyway.
He seems to be sort of body popping, doesn't he? Quite normally, he looks like he's going to, you know, get a bit of lino out and start spinning on his head any minute.
Yeah, you know, something should have been said to him, really. You know, what are you doing that for? Just walk normally, like a normal song, then.
Yeah, but the actor's Michael Kilgariff, isn't it, who, as well as playing the giant robot and several other roles during the history of the show, he actually played the original Cyber Controller in 1967. Sadly, of course, he's carrying a bit more timber than he was then. So he's a rather portly Cyberman. I think, as before, he's got no handlebars on his head like the others have, but it doesn't look that good, does it? And his body shape is completely wrong. Yeah, and the voice is not always understood. And it's a pointless piece of continuity, really, to have the same actor.
It is a pointless piece of continuity. The other thing that is annoying, really, is that the Cybermen aren't the right Cybermen. If this is supposed to be a sequel to the Cybermen, then they should look like they did in Tomb of the Cybermen.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it suggests that they've been upgrading themselves, which I suppose is possible. But, you know, it just doesn't seem right to me.
No. That said, it wouldn't seem right. I think if you had the 1967 Cybermen turning up, they'd look pretty stupid to a modern audience, I think.
I don't think they would. I think they'd look okay. Because, you know, they don't look too bad. You know, you wouldn't use the same suits, but... Now, you could make them look like they were back then, and it would still be okay.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, that's what we're left with, and it's a little bit unsuccessful, isn't it? And not only the cyber controller, to be honest, because this cyber lieutenant has a very halting way of speaking, doesn't he? And he's, throughout the story, he's got a very wonky head. And if you look carefully, there's some silver duct tape on the side of his sort of head unit. Trying to hold it into place, and you know, it just doesn't work.
Well, cyber heads, you know, seem to be notoriously easy to fall off. So maybe the cyber controller, you know, occasionally clips him around the ear, and it's you know, it's just a bit wonky.
Maybe that's it. And apparently, one of the actors playing the Cybermen was claustrophobic. So yeah, that's a bad gig, really, isn't it?
It is.
I'm wondering if it was this one, and you know, that the gaffer tape on there was just for like a quick release. You know, he'd be panicked or something like that, but it doesn't work because his head's on the sosh throughout the entire story.
Shame.
He also walks like Liam Gallagher from Oasis, doesn't he?
Yes. Anyway, they're talking about a time ship, aren't they? Which, what I got from this bit of dialogue was that it's actually Stratton and Bates' ship.
Yes.
You know, they are the original kind of pilots or whatever. The Cybertronist says that they need to bring the time ship back to Telos because it will act as an incentive for Stratton and Bates to get back to their ship, and that the Cybermen can study how their attempts to evade destruction, which seemed a bit kind of convoluted, really. But, you know, this is kind of the main part of the plot, really, this time ship, but none of it really makes sense to me, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a bit of a sort of feeble pretext. You wonder what send a squadron, you know, a squad of Cybermen just to kill the pair of them, but they don't. It's just suddenly they want to observe them scientifically. But
yeah.
Never mind. Back in the sewers, Russell reveals to the Doctor and Perry that he's an undercover police officer. The Doctor disarms him anyway and starts telling him of his own alien origins. So Russell thinks he's bonkers. But at gunpoint from a rather unconvinced Perry, he tells him he's investigating Lytton, who appeared apparently from nowhere about a year ago and stole some very specialist electronics. Clearly, you know, to the viewer, that's obviously for his transmitter that we saw at that in the garage. Mm.
But you do get a quite nasty bit here where the Doctor tells Perry to shoot him. Because he's being uncooperative, isn't he? Russell's not really giving them any information when they first take the gun off him. The Doctor tells Perry to shoot him. You know, very out of character.
Mm.
And I didn't like that. Didn't see that there was any need to do that.
No, I mean, when I watched it, I kind of think, well, he doesn't mean it. He's just trying to get some information out of him. But, you know, that's quite an unpleasant thing to do to anybody, is to, you know, have the threat of death hanging over him, isn't it?
Mm.
Which in itself is out of character, whether he meant it or not.
Yeah. Once Russell's told them this information, the Doctor gives him his gun back, doesn't he? And then he decides that they should return to the TARDIS. So they all head back that way. Back in the cyber base, the cyber leader orders a cyberman to go into the tunnels because they've detected humans nearby. There's a good line here from Griffiths. He says, perhaps it's the old Bill. They'll soon sort out this fancy dress party.
Yeah, the cyber leader orders them to be apprehended but not damaged, so that when they get them, they can be turned into Cybermen. It's a kind of recurrent theme, isn't it? They're trying to recruit more bodies to boost their sort of dwindling armies.
Mm.
Back briefly on the surface of Telos, there's a great shot of Bates and Stratton approaching cyber control. The Cybermen at cyber control detect the pair of them, and the cyber controller says, "Give the order." A quick word on Bates. He's played by Michael Atwell, who actually appeared in Doctor Who in 1967, but not in the Cybermen story, in The Ice Warrior. He played Isbur, the Ice Warrior. I guess one of the secondary Ice Warriors to Bernard Breslau's one.
Mm.
And the actor who plays Stratton, Jonathan David, was originally cast as a cyber lieutenant, old wonky head. But he was swapped to playing Stratton at very short notice after the actor was cast for that role, Trevor Raymond, broke his wrist during pre-production. Mm. He's got a bit of sci-fi pedigree as well, Jonathan David. He appeared as Servalan's lover in the Blake Seven story, Sand.
Mm.
But back to the story, Bates is still intent on getting this Cyberman's head. And as luck would have it, they spot a lone Cyberman on patrol.
So they hide, don't they, waiting for the Cybermen to sort of come their way. Stratton pops his head up from behind a sand dune and calls out. The Cybermen fires at him, and then he starts making his way up.
It's a bit of a moment like we were talking about in Seeds of Doom, wasn't it? If somebody's looking for you and you suddenly appear and say something very obvious, he actually says, "I say, are you looking for me?" It always means you've set a trap for or whoever's after you. But people always fall for it, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, but Cybermen aren't particularly clever, are they?
They don't appear to be, no.
No. Cyber leader, that's about it. So the Cybermen starts heading up towards them. As the Cybermen reaches the top, Bates jumps up and swings this kind of metal pole thing that he's been carrying, knocking the Cybermen's hand off that's holding the gun. And they push the Cybermen down the hill, and they kind of run after it. And at the bottom of the hill, the Cybermen has got to its feet and is waiting for them to knock its head off.
And they don't disappoint, do they?
No. Knock its head off, they do. And Bates picks it up, clearly delighted, you know, at his prize. And he sort of shows it to Stratton. He says, once we've cleared it out, you're going to wear it. As prisoner and escort, we might just make it inside.
Nice.
Scoop out the insides.
Yeah, delicious. I bet they won't stink at all. But another production point here, apparently the director is Matthew Robinson, who directed Resurrection of the Daleks as well, the previous Lydon story. He wanted the atmosphere on the surface of Telos to be poisonous for Cybermen, so that they have to wear blue overalls and clear plastic helmets when they're on the surface, which I think would be strange. There's a lot of beheading of Cybermen happens in this story, and this particularly key moment here. It was felt that this whole helmet thing would get in the way of that. So idea was stymied, really. Mm. But that's a fairly crap idea, I think, isn't it? Because we've seen them walking about on the moon, haven't we, in previous stories. So it's clear they don't really need to take in any air when they're going about. Therefore, you know, they wouldn't need to breathe anything toxic either, would they?
They're allergic to enough things already, so, I mean, you know, add anything else to it, then, you know, they could hardly leave the house.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, it's just a bit rubbish that it's kind of standing there waiting for its head to be knocked off. A bit better direction there is called for, I think.
Yes, yeah, but it's slightly snappier editing maybe, so.
Inside the control, Cyberman reports to the controller that the scout that they've sent out has been killed. And then we're back in the sewer, don't we?
Yeah, Perry says, these tunnels all look the same to me. Again. She says a variant of it in virtually every story she's in. Doesn't she?
I think she does. It's her catchphrase.
Yeah, I think they started doing it for a laugh, didn't they, after a while? But anyway, they spot a Cyberman down in the sewers.
Mm.
The Cyber Lieutenant detects some time distortion, and the Cyber Leader orders an investigation. And during the scene, we see the other seal worker, David, ready to be converted. And actually, the way they're kind of standing you know, with a kind of a helmet and a kind of chest unit is very, very similar to the 1960s Cybermen stories, isn't it?
Mm.
There are quite a lot of kind of visual reminders of the 60s stories, which is quite nice for the, you know, more committed fan, I think.
Mm. That's right. The Doctor uses his sonic lance to kill the Cyberman, doesn't he? He stabs it in the chest and it falls to the floor and explodes. Another easy way of killing them. The Cyber Leader is then told that the scout has been destroyed. You get another good line here from Griffiths, who says, getting a bit rough, is it? Taking the piss out of the Cyberman.
Yeah.
The Cyber Leader goes over to him and basically squeezes his head, doesn't he?
Yeah. Nice. Apparently, well, the script was that the Cyber Leader was going to kill Griffiths at this point for making that, putting on that silly voice. But Eric Say would like the character, so yeah, he just crushes his head for a bit.
Yeah, exactly. And then the Cyber Leader decides it's time to leave the base, so he sets off with Lytton and Griffiths in tow. The Doctor picks up the Cyberman's gun that they've just killed, and then they head off back out of the sewers and they start going up the ladder to get out. The Cybermen and Lytton are not far behind, are they? They've found the body of the Cyberman. Lytton pulls the Doctor's sonic lance out of the chest unit. For some reason, he realises that that's the Doctor straight away.
Yeah.
Which doesn't quite add up, I don't think, but anyway.
Maybe he'd written his name along the side of
the... Oh, he might have done, yeah. A bit like sewing your name in your pants, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. You know, anyone stealing these things.
Exactly. So he mentions... the Doctor and the Cyber Leader obviously knows who the Doctor is and is very keen on getting his TARDIS. So they up the pace in pursuit, don't they?
Yes. Meanwhile, the Doctor and gang have gone back up out of the sewers and into the garage to find that the handcuffed policeman has gone missing.
Mm-hmm.
I think we know where he is, didn't we? We saw him lined up ready to be converted.
Indeed.
They go into the pipe organ that shakes TARDIS. But when they get inside, they find that Sidemen are already there.
Mm, the doors are already open, isn't it?
Mm, and it's quite a genuine sort of shock jump, isn't there, when the Doctor's kind of moving into the console room and a cyber arm shoots from out of shot and grabs him around the neck.
Mm.
That made me jump quite a lot.
Russell, though, comes to his rescue, doesn't he? And he shoots the Sidemen in the head, and then he steps forward and at point-blank range shoots it again.
Mm.
And the Sidemen, the kind of flap at the back of its head flaps open, doesn't it? And it crumples to the floor and explodes. Well, quite nasty, I thought that was.
Yeah.
It's unnecessary.
Still, it did the job.
Yeah, it did the job, but you know, just the way it was shot, and you get this thing where he's actually got the gun literally against its face.
Mm.
You know, I know it's a Cyberman, it's still a bit grim.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a toddler, but yeah, it's still a bit grim.
Or a kitten.
A fluffy kitten. Yes. Anyway, Russell picks up the cyber gun of the presumably belonging to Simon. He's just wasted.
Mm.
And he accidentally shoots at the TARDIS wall, doesn't he?
Mm.
Interestingly, eagle-eyed viewers will notice that the black mark this shot leaves is visible several scenes earlier in the TARDIS, before the gun was fired.
Oops.
So shot out of sequence, and I think the continuity person needs to be shot as well. But yeah, he wanders a little bit further around the kind of TARDIS console, and a Sidemen emerges from deeper in the TARDIS, doesn't he?
Mm.
And Russell shoots him, and then sees that some more are coming through the doorway behind Perry. So yeah, he warns Perry, but another one comes from behind him, and with one cyber punch from behind, he's killed, isn't he?
He
staggers some distance into the TARDIS and then falls over. Apparently this was required from in production terms so that he could cover a cable when he landed.
Well, he'd lay the cable, has he?
Yeah, it was considered as a family show that shouldn't be shown.
There's lots of people shouting, no, no, at this point, isn't there?
Oh, it's very badly scripted or shot or whatever, isn't it?
Because,
yeah, you get no, no, no. Very clumsy.
Exactly. Anyway, Perry kind of runs over to Russell. Obviously, it's too late. And then the cyber leader comes in with Litton and Griffiths and orders Perry to be killed. So one of the cybermen wanders over and raises its arm to strike her. And that's the end of the episode.
Yes. She kind of screws up her face, doesn't she, as she's about to be hit. And some say appears to be smiling at the end. I don't think she is, but there are complaints that you know, it should have been that scene should have been cut slightly earlier because they think she's out. You know, Nicola Bryant is then out of character and smiling about having shot the scene.
Yeah.
I don't think she is personally.
I've never noticed that. I'll have to have a quick look. It's a shame. It could be quite a good scene, but it's just poorly shot, really, isn't it? It just doesn't quite hang together well enough.
No, it's quite action-packed, isn't it? But that kind of everyone shouting no consecutively is pretty poor, isn't it?
Mm.
And it's a little bit unconvincing, Russell's death, I think.
So we start the second episode. The Doctor shouts out, wait! And the Cyber Leader stops his Cyber Man from killing Perry. And then the Doctor bargains for a life, doesn't he? Says that he'll cooperate if they spare her. But just in case, he sets a self-destruct mechanism on the TARDIS, doesn't he? As a kind of a bargaining chip with the Cyber Leader. Mm. So the Cyber Leader orders Perry to be freed, and he gives his word, and that of the Cyber Controller, on Telos.
Ooh.
I don't think I'd trust their word between them.
No, I don't even.
Anyway, the Doctor eventually stops. There's this countdown going on the console, isn't there? And he stops it as it gets to one, and then the Cyber Leader tells him to set the coordinates for Telos, which he starts to do.
Yeah, there's an interesting bit here, isn't it? Because the Cyber Leader then says, correct, we can now time travel. A line from the script was left out here. The Doctor is supposed to have said it isn't possible that these Cybermen can be from Telos, as it's in a different time zone. So that makes more sense when he then says, correct, we can now time travel. We need that line out. he just says, correct, we can now time travel. And everyone goes, well, we didn't ask about that, did we?
Yeah. Everyone kind of looks at each other. What's he on about now? Simon's scratching their heads. Back on Telos, Stratton and Bates are playing around this cyber head. Stratton reluctantly puts it on, doesn't he? And he also puts on a cyber chest unit. So he looks reasonably like a Cyberman. Although he doesn't think it's going to work. Bates, you know, is more convinced.
Back into the TARDIS, the Doctor, Perry, Griffiths and Lytton are placed in one of the sort of ante rooms next to the console room. Lytton explains that the Cybermen don't actually understand the laws of time, which is what the Doctor's worried about, but they did capture a time vessel that landed on Telos. The Doctor's puzzled at how Lytton knows so much about Telos and what the Cybermen are up to, but Lytton kind of avoids the question, doesn't he? He does mention that he wasn't working for the Daleks out of choice in Resurrection of the Daleks, and that becomes a quite significant statement, I think, a little bit later on.
Mm. The Doctor thinks he's a spy, doesn't he, basically? You know, he doesn't believe anything that Lytton's saying. On Telos, the cyber controller, they've basically found that there's a signal coming from the TARDIS, that the Doctor's managed to send some sort of signal, presumably to the Time Lords, which I didn't really understand. But he says that they'll be too late, as Telos will have been destroyed, and they'll have the Doctor's TARDIS. Did that make any sense to you?
I'm wondering if the signal is something to do with Lytton. Well, the Doctor's tinkering with the TARDIS, isn't he? And what he's tinkering is there to do is to knock them off course a little bit, isn't it?
That's right. And that's kind of in the next scene. But before that, you get the cyber controller who's already saying that there's some signal coming from the TARDIS.
Yeah, I think it's Lytton signalling to the Cryons.
Yeah, it could be.
I don't think it's followed up, is it?
It's unclear what's going on there, anyway. But then, as you say, the Doctor starts to play around with one of the roundels on the wall, doesn't he? And he's trying to knock the navigation off a little bit so that they don't land where they're supposed to be landing. Mm. Lytton actually gives the Doctor back his sonic lance so he can use it on the controls behind his panel. And the Doctor kind of gives him a look, doesn't he? And reluctantly kind of accepts it from him, doesn't he? And then they start talking about Telos, and the Doctor mentions this race called the Cryons that used to live there before the Cybermen arrived, and that they had a genius for refrigeration, and they can't live in temperatures above zero. The Cybermen apparently killed them. Perry asks why they're on Telos, and they got a home planet. And the Doctor looks a bit sheepish, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. And everyone sort of asks the question, and Lytton does too, but with a slight edge to his voice, doesn't he?
Mm.
We'll find out why later. The Cybermen in the TARDIS console room get word of the irregular signal that's coming from the TARDIS that was spotted at cyber control, and the cyber leader orders the Doctor to be brought to him. Back with the Doctor, he's explaining the events of the 10th Planet, basically, which is William Hartnell's last story, where the Cybermen had installed a propulsion unit into their home planet, which was Mondas. This brought them close to Earth, and they started drawing energy from the Earth before. With the Doctor's help, Mondas was eventually destroyed. So Lytton is enjoying the Doctor's guilt trip, really, isn't he, that the reason that the Cybermen had to look for another planet and ended up on Telos is because the Doctor, among others, had destroyed their home planet.
Again, this bit's unclear as to why they're trying to wind it up. The Doctor wasn't really anything to do with Mondas being destroyed, was it? Because it kind of just destroys itself in the 10th Planet. And he's comatose with most of it anyway. I thought that the Doctor was trying to avoid talking about it because it happens next year. They're in 1985, and this thing with Mondas is going to happen next year. And he didn't really want to tell them all about it.
Oh, I think he...
You think he feels guilty for being
responsible? I think he does, and I think that's what Lytton's enjoying. And I think the Doctor only twigs that it's next year as somebody asks him when it happens. Because he kind of sort of falters in a sentence, doesn't he? And says, 1986.
Yeah.
So I think it's more guilt than worrying about the next bit. But then, of course, he is left in a position of Perry saying to him, well, if you know it's going to happen, why didn't you warn the authorities that, that Mondas is going to turn up and start, basically attacking the Earth? And the doctor says, well, I can't. It's, you know, I'd be breaking the rules of time.
Mm. I think what's clear about this is that all this continuity nonsense is, doesn't help this story at all, does it?
Well, it bogs it down more than anything.
Yeah, and if there were any casual viewers watching at this time, they wouldn't have had a clue what was going on.
No. There's another interesting line from Lytton. The Kryons are mentioned in passing again, and Perry says, oh, I'm not interested in the Kryons. And Lytton seems quite disgusted by this and says, oh, well, there's compassion for you. Mm. Which, again, is more significant later on.
Yeah. A Cyberman comes in and takes Perry out of the room, and he tells the doctor that he's wanted in the console room. So they start heading out. And then you get a cut to a scene with a rogue Cyberman who is kind of wandering around waving its arms.
Covered in green slime.
Covered in some green slime, yeah. In a as yet unseen area on Telos. More of which for later. In Cyber Control, news of this rogue Cyberman is given to the Cyber Controller, and he tells them to stop the resuscitation. And they've been resuscitating these Cybermen, but obviously something's going on, you know, with these rogues, and he orders the rogue to be destroyed.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting idea, isn't it, that they're going around resuscitating them, but a lot of them are coming out as baddens, aren't they, and killing the resuscitation team.
Yeah.
So right, enough's enough, there's too many casualties, just stop resuscitating, because, you know, something is going wrong here, and we'll find out what that is later on.
Yeah, exactly.
But another annoying thing about the fat controller, Cyber Controller, is that he does quite a lot of his conversation straight to camera, doesn't he?
Yes.
As if he's breaking the fourth wall, which is unnecessary and a bit annoying.
True. Back in the TARDIS console room, the Cyber Leader tells the Doctor that Perry's been taken to put on some warm clothing, because when they arrive on Telos, it's going to be freezing cold. And then he grabs the Doctor by the shoulders, doesn't he, and tells him to stop the signal that he's been sending, which he does. So it is obviously the Doctor sending this signal. That's what I was confused about earlier. It's definitely the Doctor that's doing it, but it's unclear what he's doing, because it doesn't seem to be connected to the fact that he's changing where they're going to land, does it?
I've seen this a few times before, and I watched it twice before this podcast, and I never put those two together, so either I'm thick, which is quite possible, or there's just quite a lot that's going on that's quite complicated and not really explained very well.
The former, definitely.
I wish I put money on you saying that.
Yeah, the Cyber Leader then warns the Doctor that if he tries anything like that again, he'll kill him. And they give him a bit of heavy treatment, don't they?
Yeah, they rough him up a bit. Yes, back on the surface of Telos, just another quick scene. Bates is pushing Stratton onwards, really. He's complaining that he's tired and he can't breathe in the helmet. He wants to sit down, but Bates says, you know, Cybermen don't rest, and drags him on as sort of prisoner and escort to Cyber Control, although clearly it's the prisoner that seems to be pushing the escort.
Yeah, he almost bursts a blood vessel while he's doing it as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's got anger issues, hasn't he?
He certainly has.
He needs some anger management, I think, Bates.
Perry reappears in a red boiler suit, and then the TARDIS lands in the tombs on Telos on level 4, which is where the rogue side member's seen a bit earlier. This time, the TARDIS actually does appear to blend in, doesn't it? It appears to be kind of like two doors, but it fits in with the surroundings, so...
Yeah, it's a little bit too ornate, but at least it's not that obvious that it even is a TARDIS, is it? So it must be doing quite a good job.
That's right. Yeah. When they come out, there appears to be kind of a rancid atmosphere, and Perry complains about the cold as well. The Cyber Leader complains to the Doctor that they've materialised in the wrong place, which the Doctor's kind of, oh, really? Not sure. Don't know anything about that. But the Cyber Leader appears to be a bit worried about it, doesn't he? And Lytton sort of points that out. They wonder what's up. And then there's this horrible smell, which Lytton, he says it's death. The stale, rank odour of death is unmistakable.
Yeah, cheers everyone up.
The Doctor thinks he knows more than he's letting on, doesn't he?
The Cyber Leader returns, doesn't he, and says they're going to have to leave at once. As he's saying this, the cyber sentry that's kind of looking after the humans and humanoids has his head punched clean off. by a rogue sideman, doesn't he? Bursts out of his little cell. That's another generally shocking moment, I think.
It is. That was really shocking. I'd love to be able to punch a sideman's head clean off.
You'll get your chance one day. Don't try it at conventions, because it probably isn't a real sideman.
Oh, there are people on the inside of those suits.
No, just ignore what I said. And don't let anyone tell you anything about Father Christmas. So.
What are you talking about?
Nothing. Move on.
Okay. Right. Lytton and Griffiths manage to get away during this, don't they, while this kind of melee going on. The rogue sideman has a bit of a tussle with the cyber leader. The cyber leader sort of pushes it to the floor, which manages to kill it.
Well, we know how flimsy these sidemen
are. I'm surprised his head didn't fall off. The doctor pushes Perry in the direction that Lytton and Griffiths had run, doesn't he? And she legs it as well. But the doctor's kind of left with the cyber leader, who orders the other cybermen not to harm the doctor because they need him.
Yes. Meanwhile, we catch up with Perry, who's running through this sort of tomb area. And another rogue sideman bursts out of its cell and attacks her. But a pair of strange figures appear. They turn out to be the Kryons. They seem to have purloined a cyber gun, which they use on the Cybermen, and drag Perry away. But they're, more of the Kryons later, but they're female, sort of white creatures, aren't they?
Who like waving their hands around a lot.
Yeah, they do, yes.
And touching people's faces. Lytton and Griffiths also meet up with a Kryon, who turns out to be called Threst. And we find out here that Lytton's been working with the Kryons to defeat the Cybermen.
It turns out, after the events of Resurrection of the Daleks, when Lytton was stranded on Earth, he sent out a distress call, and the Kryons answered it. He told them that he was stranded on Earth, and they told him that Telos had been invaded by the Cybermen, so they kind of forged some sort of an agreement. And then everything since was Lytton manipulating the Cybermen into bringing him and originally, I guess, his team to Telos, but of course it's only him and Griffiths now, as the other two have carked it.
Griffiths is upset that a couple of people have already died, but Threst says that he also is needed to help the Kryons, and that they'll they'll pay him for it. He wonders what they could have that he could possibly want, and Lytton produces these diamonds. Is there about 2 million in uncut diamonds? But apparently diamonds are common on Telos, and the Kryons say that all Griffiths needs to do is help Lytton steal the timeship.
Yeah, they reiterate the fact that the Kryons can't exist in temperatures above freezing, so they need Lytton and Griffiths to do that, the work above ground and out of these refrigerated cities. But even despite the amount of uncut diamonds being waved in his face, Griffiths still isn't that keen. But Lytton tells him the alternative to helping Kryons is to be turned into an emotional Cyberman. So that seems to concentrate his mind a bit.
The Doctor, meanwhile, has been shut in a room full of canisters. In the room with him is another Kryon who turns out to be called Flask. We find out that Griffith's task is to keep Lytton alive. He's supposed to be a bodyguard for him. Griffiths is worried that he's not going to stay alive long enough to be able to spend any money that he's going to make from these diamonds. And then we also see Perry with the other two Kryons, and they tell her that their names are Varn and Rost, and that they're Kryons, and that they no longer have a planet.
Yeah, it's a bit odd this, because Perry's actually sort of asleep or unconscious, isn't she, at the beginning of the scene?
Yeah, not sure why.
Yeah, so they Rohypnol her on the way, but she suddenly comes to, but yeah, a bit strange. Back on the surface of Telos, Bates and Stratton are still making their way to cyber control when they see Lytton and Griffiths coming through a hatch onto the surface of Telos.
Meanwhile, Flask is telling the Doctor about the Kryons and how they survived. The Doctor wants to escape from this room that he locked him in. Flask says, yes, it's the locked door and the armed guard that's the unsolvable problem. And the Doctor responds with, and maybe the lack of support from your cellmate?
Yeah, she's got a slightly dismal outlook, hasn't she?
She has, yeah.
We find out from her that it's the Kryons that have been sabotaging the tombs that the Cybermen are using to muck up the resuscitation. So that's what's been causing all this.
That's right, and she also tells the Doctor that the Cybermen's plan, which is to change history by stopping Mondas from being destroyed.
Bam, bam, bam. Back at Cyber Control, the Cybermen have set and primed explosives on the surface of Telos. and the Fat Controller orders a TARDIS to be brought to him again, because I think that's what he asked in the last scene.
Yeah, they seem a bit like padding these scenes with the Fat Controller, don't they?
They do, don't they?
Lytton and Griffiths are confronted by Stratton and Bates, who appear from behind the big sand dune.
It's interesting, is it, because Lytton has a Cyberman detector, basically, doesn't he? And he thinks that there's two of them very close by, but of course it's Bates and Stratton, who aren't yet completely Cybermen, but obviously quite a long way there.
Yeah. Bates orders Griffiths to drop his gun, which he does. Lytton starts talking to them and says, "You must be Stratton and Bates." And of course that surprises them. And they, as they're kind of patting down Griffiths, they realise that they're flesh and blood, and they're not Cybermen, and the same for Lytton. So they wonder what's going on. And then Bates shows Griffiths his metal arm, doesn't he? And squeezes his hand, causing him to grimace quite sharply.
Yes. A very graphic demonstration of how he's been cyberneticised.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both Bates and Stratton have had their limbs converted, haven't they? But the mental conditioning hasn't worked.
Yeah, so they're kind of rejects, aren't they? Mm. So obviously they use these rejects to do the work on the surface.
Yeah, they're obviously expendable. Lytton knows that Bates and Stratton need at least three people to pilot their time vessel, and you know that's the only way off Telos. Thanks to the Kryons, he has a safe route for reaching the launching pad. So between them, they've got everything they need to make their escape.
Perry, meanwhile, is worried about the Doctor. The Kryons say that they can't really help her because they can't get to him without dying. They'd have to go outside, you know, where there's a higher temperature, which will kill them. Perry, though, is surprised that they know who the Doctor is. So, you know, there's a picture of him on a scanner, isn't there, that they're looking at. She works out from that they know Lytton. And this is when we find out what the Kryons are up to, that Lytton is there to help them stop the Cybermen leaving Telos. The Cybermen want to study the effect of the explosion, you know, that they're going to set off, the effect that that will have on Telos's atmosphere. Seems a bit convoluted. What is it they're trying to do? They think there are about three or four different plans going on at once, don't they?
Well, yeah, might as well say now that they want to divert Halley's Comet to destroy the Earth before the Earth destroys Mondas.
Mm.
But at the same time, they want to destroy Telos as a scientific experiment, which seems a bit woolly.
It does, doesn't it?
So, yeah, it's a bit strange. And if you've destroyed Telos before you've seen the outcome of what happens with Halley's Comet, then you might end up with no planets to live on.
Yeah, it's either two birds with one stone or biting off more than you chew, one or the other.
Well, too many cooks spoil the broth.
Yeah, any more with shoehorn in there?
many hands make light work.
It's clear now that the Cybermen are tracking Stratton and Bates, and they know exactly where they are. They're now kind of almost inside cyber control, aren't they, with Lytton and Griffiths.
Yes. At this point, Flast actually reveals, as we just said, that the Cybermen are going to divert Halley's Comet and use it as a natural bomb to crash into the Earth. The Doctor is outraged at this plan. Saving Mondas is contributing the laws of time, and he's surprised that the Time Lords aren't doing something to stop it. And then, with a sudden moment of clarity, he realises with some fury that it must have been the Time Lords who sent the TARDIS off course and manipulated him into all this story, basically, to be their agent once again, as we saw, particularly during the Pertwee era and sometimes during the Tom Baker years as well.
That's right, and he starts shouting at the ceiling. Flask shows the Doctor what's in these containers that are in the room with them, and it turns out to be a substance called Vastil, which is an unstable mineral, which explodes at temperatures above 10 to 15 degrees, which is quite handy, isn't it, really? It doesn't make much sense for the Cybermen to shut them in there with it either, does it? So, no. The place is actually full of the stuff. The Cybermen clearly know that that's what it is, because a bit later you see them bringing it out, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, they've kept it very, very cold in there, and actually Colin Baker's quite convincing, isn't he, in his depiction of how cold it is in the room. But yeah, it's a bit strange, isn't it? Just putting someone in an armoury, basically, when it's supposed to be your prison. And of course, it comes in handy. We'll be surprised to learn.
Mm.
Meanwhile, Lytton and co. have approached the landing pad. There's actually a nice bit of handheld camera, isn't there, when they go up the ladder, the camera pointing down them. But the other three go up the ladder, but Lytton at the back is captured by a Cyberman patrol, and the others just say, well, he's at it, let's go. Bates says that. And there's a really nice point of view shot, isn't there, as Lytton's on the floor looking up at his Cybermen captors. It's really good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good. The Doctor is collecting some of this Bastille in a little container because he thinks he can use it to get rid of the guard outside the door. And he manages to open the door with... He must use sonic glass, doesn't he?
He does, yeah.
Yeah, to open the door. And he pops the container outside. The cyber guard sees him do it and he comes over to see what's going on. And as he gets to this little container, it explodes. And it kind of sets fire to his arm, doesn't it? The cyber starts batting at his arm with his gun to try and put it out. But all it does, it kind of spreads the fire further around him and eventually it starts exploding. He falls to the floor and then explodes in a big shower of sparks.
Nice.
Inside, Flask tells the Doctor that, you know, she can't leave the room because if she went outside the corridor, she'd die. She asks the Doctor to leave behind his sonic lance because there's enough explosive in the room to annihilate cyber control, so she can use the sonic lance to heat it up and set it off.
Good stuff. Meanwhile, the Kryans, who are with Perry, want the TARDIS moved out of the Cyberman's hands, basically. But they unfortunately expect Perry to pilot the TARDIS. She tells them that she can't, but they don't really take no for an answer, do they?
No.
Particularly when they get radioed through that you know, their ally Lytton has been taken prisoner, and you know, it makes it ever more important to stop the Cybermen having the TARDIS.
And then we get the controversial scene, don't we?
Yes.
Lytton in cyber control. The cyber controller is asking him questions, which he refuses to answer. And two Cybermen are kind of grabbing him by the hands, and they basically crush his hands.
Into a bloody pulp.
Yeah, basically into a bloody pulp, indeed. And he screams and falls to the floor, clutching them with blood everywhere. Pretty grim.
It is grim, and it's a pretty flimsy pretext for this torture as well. The cyber controller wants to know how Lytton was going to steal or destroy the time vessel. And that's what all this is about, apparently. Well, how are you going to steal it? Well, you go to it and get inside and fly it. How do you destroy it? You go to it and you put some explosive in it and destroy it. The pretext for this torture just it seems to be non-existent.
Yeah, it's totally unnecessary. And
oddly, the production team had a policy where they wanted to make the show more violent at this stage, which is odd because throughout the sort of Graham Williams era, at the end of Tom Baker's reign, you know, they're under strict orders to make it less violent.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're trying to make it more adult or, I mean, the time slot hadn't changed at all. And it is a deeply unpleasant scene and entirely unnecessary as well.
It is. I mean, it's quite a violent story, this, but that exceeds anything else in it, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, but there's very little violence to humans. There's no bloody violence to humans, is there? And blowing up a Kryon or knocking the head of a Cyberman doesn't seem so bad somehow, does it? But once you start seeing blood, I think you have to be very, very careful.
It's a step too far. Anyway, the cyber controller orders Lytton to be taken to be converted. So that's what happens. Then, there's a few scenes. We get Flask putting the sonic lance inside one of the containers of Bastille and then sitting and waiting. The time vessel approaches and it actually lands on top of cyber control, doesn't it?
This is a very kind of 1960s scene, I think, isn't it? It reminds me, I think it's a scene from the Dalek Master Plan, isn't it? Where there's a very similar vessel lands in quite a similar, you know, kind of model area.
Mm.
And I think it's a nice touch because there are quite a few throwbacks to the 60s, as we've said, throughout this, and I think this is another one. And yeah, to the long-term fan, I think it's quite a nice one.
They realise also that the Doctor's escaped at this point as well.
Bates and Stratton hear this time vessel landing, so you know it gives, as the cyber controller said, it gives them extra incentive to keep going. Meanwhile, the Doctor and Perry bump into each other in sort of tomb areas on Telos. And the Doctor finds basically a dead Cyberman in one of the cells and activates a distress beacon in its head in order to lure the Cybermen who are guarding the TARDIS away from the TARDIS and towards them. Interestingly, he opens the head of the Cyberman and it it seems to be entirely electronic in there, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And not at all organic, as we're kind of led to believe that it is. I mean, one of the big things that was made about the kind of transparent jaw from the Earthshock side men was that you could see this kind of silver sort of humanoid jaw moving inside. But you can see the jaw when they open this up, but it's, you know, it seems to be a slab of metal with electronics attached to it.
Yes. It would have been better if they'd done it from the back or something, or...
Yeah.
Or it had been somewhere else, you know, something in the chest unit or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree, it was a bit rubbish. The other thing that amused me about this was the doctor says they've got an inbuilt distress signal. It's their one weakness. Their one weakness is that they will react to a distress signal from their own kind. My immediate thought was, what about all their other weaknesses? Like, you know, their heads will fall off if there's a strong wind, and, you know, they can be shot, catapults, anything really. Nail polish remover.
Yeah, gold. Maybe he meant it was their 100th weakness.
Yeah, maybe there's another missing line there.
Yeah, you're right, they're riddled with weaknesses. But never mind. Meanwhile, the cyber leader and a couple of cyber henchmen go and investigate the room that the doctor's escaped from, but they find Flash still there. She refuses to tell them anything, so they basically quite unpleasantly force her out into the warm corridor, and she sort of staggers around and starts evaporating. And quite horribly, the cyber leader kind of stands still and emotionless, filling the doorway, and she tries to get back into the cold storeroom, but can't, and just sort of claws feebly at him and staggers back into the corridor and dies. And it again sort of reinforces how vile the Cybermen are in this story. They're really quite brutal.
They definitely are. Stratton, Bates and Griffiths arrived at the time ship. They come to a closed door, don't they? Behind the door is the ship, and they're quite excited that they're nearly there. Bates goes to open the door. As he touches it, he's electrocuted. Very reminiscent of when they try to get into the tombs and tomb the Cybermen.
Yeah, it's another nice touch, isn't it? Another hark back to that story.
The other two go to Bates to see whether he's alive or dead, and the door opens behind them to reveal a Cyber Scout, who basically just shoots the two of them. So they're all, after all of that, they're just killed in a very short scene.
Yeah, it's bleak, isn't it, really?
It is bleak. A bit gratuitous, really, as well. And also, it's like, well, surely they must realise there's going to be Cybermen inside it, because how else did they manage to pilot it then?
Yeah, I suppose they thought they this time they'd just land it and just go and have a cup of tea or something.
Putting their feet up.
Yeah. They don't show, you know, any kind of stealth, do they? Just open the door and that's that. But, you know, clearly the trap was set by the Cybermen, but they weren't expecting it. Yeah, poor show, I suppose. At this point, we see a half-converted Lytton lined up with the others, and he doesn't look a well man, does he?
No, he's had better days, I think.
Yes, and the Cybermen start examining the Vastule in the cold store to see whether it's been tampered with.
And they start moving the boxes out of the room, don't they? Not sure what they're doing.
Yeah, that's not explained, is it? Maybe they're going to take them with them before they destroy the planet. The doctor's distress signal in the dead Cybermen is working. The cyber guards leave the TARDIS and are ambushed by the Kryons, and there's a bit of a shootout, and one of the Kryons, Varn, gets killed.
Yeah, she goes all swirly, doesn't she?
Oh, it's horrible, that, when you go all swirly.
It's a bit of a weird effect.
I suppose she's sort of turning to steam or something.
Yeah, they managed to shoot a couple. Well, there's only two of the Cybermen there, isn't there? So it's 2-1 to the Kryons. And then they manage to get past. There's a safe passage back to the TARDIS. The doctor tells Rost that he's sorry that Barnes has been killed. She tells him just to remove the TARDIS and leave, and that the Kryons will be fine. At this point, Perry tells the doctor that Lytton has been working for the Kryons. Rost confirms this, and then Perry says they can't just leave him to die. The doctor's in a bit of a flap, isn't he? He's sort of, you know, why didn't he tell me, and it's on their side. But anyway, they go into the TARDIS and dematerialise.
Yeah, the Fat Controller is informed that the Cybermen guarding the TARDIS aren't responding anymore, and also some time distortion has been detected. So quite rightly, he deduces that the TARDIS has been moved. And sure enough, the TARDIS materialises in the sort of conversion area, doesn't it?
Mm.
And, once again, it's back as a police box, isn't it?
It is.
unexplained, but it stays like that forever afterwards. The doctor discovers the partially converted Lytton and thinks that he can help him, but Lytton basically says that the drug that he'd used him is controlling his mind, and he's had it basically, and just begs the doctor to kill him.
At this point, the cyber controller enters the room, and basically the doctor manages to slip a knife into Lytton's hand, doesn't he, as the cyber controller's talking. Controller approaches, and Lytton manages to stab him in the arm. Again, we get the green fluid spraying out everywhere.
Just before that, the cyber controller, as he advances towards the doctor, just shoehorns in the usual argument about emotions being a weakness. Just, he just basically wanders in and says, emotions are a weakness.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
Well, the fact that the doctor's come back to help listen, I suppose.
I suppose so, but it just felt like it was a checklist of things that have to happen in a Cyberman story.
Yeah.
One is the argument about emotions being great or being weak.
Exactly.
And quick, there's only a few minutes left.
We haven't said it. Quick. But anyway, so Lytton stabs the cyber controller in the arm, and the cyber controller starts, he goes a bit mad, doesn't he? Flailing around all over the place.
Yeah.
And it all kicks off, really. More Cybermen enter. The cyber leader enters, doesn't he? With another Cyberman. The doctor manages to grab, I think it's the cyber controller's gun. He must have dropped it when Lytton stabbed him. He shoots the cyber leader and the guard. One of them seems to shoot the other one, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So it's all a bit kind of frantic. Meanwhile, the controller's still flailing about, knocking the doctor over several times, and eventually the doctor manages to get enough room between him and the controller to actually fire at him, and he kills him.
Apparently at this point, Colin Baker went to stand astride the prone body of the cyber controller and just pump shots into him to make sure he's dead, because he wanted to show the doctor losing control completely and showing his dark side, but apparently this was vetoed.
So all the Cybermen are dead on the floor, and Perry comes out of the TARDIS. She seems to have been watching it all over the scanner, doesn't she? The doctor goes over to check on Lytton, but he's already dead. And he says he can't just leave him there, but Perry says, you know, we haven't got any time. We need to leave in the TARDIS. She convinces him to leave. So off they go. Meanwhile, down below in the Vastior room, two Cybermen spot the smoking container that's got the Doctor's sonic lance in it. One of them sort of waves at the other one and sort of makes Leggett motions, doesn't he?
For emotionless entities, they got a bit of a flap, don't they?
They do. He sort of, you know, makes some motions, then sort of grabs his arm and sort of helps him out of the room.
Yeah.
Quite comical. But it all starts exploding. You know, you see some explosion in the room, and then you cut to the model shot outside, and the whole thing explodes in a reasonably poor explosion. Well, it is. If you think about the explosion in Caesar 2 from last podcast, it's just kind of like, I don't know, firecracker type stuff, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Not very good.
Anyway, back in the TARDIS console room, the doctor's basically reflects on how he's misjudged Lytton, doesn't he?
He does.
And the story ends.
Yes, didn't go very well, did it? that's the doctor's line.
not your review.
I don't think I've ever misjudged anyone as badly as I did Lytton. Yeah, so that's it.
Well, a quick word on ratings. Part one got 8.9 million viewers, which is good. Yeah, I mean, it's the first story of the series, wasn't it? And, you know, and people are still curious to see what the Colin Baker Doctor would be like, I think, as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
Sadly, after watching an episode, it went down to 7.2 million the next week, which is a substantial drop, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I think it continues to drop throughout the season, isn't it? So recall. But yeah, what did you think of it overall?
Well, I remember thinking at the time it was a return to form, but then after Twin Dilemma, yeah, anything's a return to form, isn't it? Is considered one of the worst, if not the worst, Doctor Who stories ever, isn't it, in the fan community, Twin Dilemma. And I remember enjoying this one at the time, and it is superficially enjoyable, I think, as long as you don't think too hard about it.
Yeah.
There are some exciting moments in it, definitely, and there's some good shocks, as I mentioned, and I think the first episode is excellent. Yeah. I think the second episode isn't. It doesn't fulfill the promise of the first episode at all, I don't think.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Part one is really good, and I really enjoyed it, but as soon as I get to Telos, for me, it loses it, really. All the kind of tension and eeriness goes out of the story, and it's too brash, and it just doesn't make any sense. You have to really concentrate to get any idea of what the plot's on about.
Mm. There's too much continuity, isn't there, which even for Dyed in the Wool fans like us is a little bit tricky to follow. And for casual viewers, I mean, the first story of a series, it has to be a jumping on point for new viewers, doesn't it?
Mm.
And if you make it something that's so cliquey and requires so much foreknowledge as this one does, then you immediately alienate new viewers, and maybe that's illustrated in the drop in viewing figures from the first episode to the second. I don't think it's all bad. As I say, there's some good bits. I like all the scenes on the surface of Telos, which I think are excellent, and all of the scenes really with Stratton and Bates are really good. The Sidemen are menacing again. I think they lost a bit of their menace in the Five Doctors. They are still too vulnerable, though.
Yeah.
Aren't they? They're far too vulnerable. But, you know, it obviously became a sort of crowd pleaser to bust bits off Sidemen, and that continues from the Five Doctors into this story.
Yeah.
Colin Baker is much better, I think, than he was in Twin Dilemma. Although I would say, of most of the actors who played the Doctor on screen, he appears to be acting more than the others do.
Mm.
If you see what I mean, his performance is most of the time not very naturalistic, although he does have his moments.
Yeah, I'd agree with nearly everything you've said there. I think the thing that really lets this down, other than the convoluted plot, is the Doctor.
Oh, really?
I think he's unlikable. He's smug, overbearing, constant arguing with Perry just puts you off and is annoying. And I agree that he's just trying too hard, it seems to me, to get a character where, I think he does settle down a bit. He's not as bad as this in Varos, for instance.
No.
But I thought it was, from the first scene he was in at the start, I just thought, oh God, just jarred with me. And it's a shame, because it might be seen in a different light if it wasn't for this, you know. If it had a better Doctor in it.
Yeah, that's true.
But I agree, I think the first part is excellent. I agree, that's the same word you used, but it is. It's just a shame that it's let down with the second part. It just becomes almost unintelligible. You don't really know what's going on. The Cybermen, not as keen on them as you were. I think all the stuff with them being easily killed does detract too much. Besides, the Fat Controller is rubbish, as I said earlier.
Yeah, he's ludicrous.
We missed. There's a bit in it where one of the Cybermen actually calls him the Fat Controller as well.
Really?
He questions what one of the one of his aides says to him. And his aide says, "It's a Fat Controller." And he says it so quickly. It's a Fat Controller.
It certainly is.
The SKPs have destroyed the Cyber Scouts. That is not possible. It is a Fat Controller.
But his rubbish. Yeah. I think the Cyber Leader is very good, as he normally is, actually. David Banks does a good job as a Cyber Leader.
Oh, interesting point about David Banks. He was actually first choice to play Jondar in Vengeance on Varos.
Right.
Which eventually, for some reason, he ended up not doing it, but of course it went to the rather wooden Jason Connery. But it'd be interesting to see him out of as himself rather than as a Cyberman, but he was denied that, unfortunately. But we haven't really talked about the Kryons, have we?
No, the Kryons, I thought, were okay. They were reasonable. I haven't got any big problems with them. The casting was a bit pointless. You know, they had these kind of big name women, Faith Brown, Sarah Green.
Yeah, they were going to have Kew Stark, weren't they, at one point? But
pointless to have them.
Yeah, it could have been anybody under all that that mask, yeah. I thought they were a very, very 1960s-style alien.
Mm.
I thought they looked like that, really. You can imagine them sort of popping up in the Underwater Menace sort of thing. And they had a whiff of the Monoptera about them, don't they? Those sort of slightly fey aliens, all those sort of alien hand movements and all the rest of it. They got quite a wry sense of humour, haven't they? That makes them quite sort of choice remarks through the story. But overall, I didn't think they were that convincing. I mean, they're pretty okay except for the heads. They've got a strange sort of moustache and a sort of Elizabethan ruff around the neck.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, they're not. I don't think they're terrible, but they're not fantastic either. They're just kind of like, they're okay.
But they're clearly a person pretending to be an alien, aren't they? Which is a problem. They're not in any way convincing. But it's a presence, they're fairly alien, aren't they? And it's good to have aliens that are on the side of the Doctor and his side of things, because it doesn't really happen that often, does it?
That's right. We've already mentioned the sub in the sewers, all that stuff was good. I thought Morris Coburn as Lytton was excellent.
Yeah, as always. Yeah.
All of the scenes he was in were brilliant. I thought Bates as a character was really good.
Yeah.
Full of anger and his lines to Stratton were superb. And I loved Brian Glover as Griffiths as well.
Oh, he was great, yeah.
You know, the banter between him and Lytton and others. You know, and some of the dialogue was really good. It's a funny story because it's half of it's good and half of it's rubbish.
Yeah.
It's a difficult one to actually score, I think.
Yeah, but I loved all the stuff with the criminals. It's not an area that the show's really delved into, because that kind of human criminal fraternity.
No.
And as I say, apart from some intrusive incidental music, I thought those scenes are excellent. And it really felt like the show was going in a new direction for 45 minutes, and then the next 45 minutes it wasn't. Yeah, good stuff. Good stuff, and a great way to reintroduce Lytton, I think was worthy of a reappearance.
Yeah.
And a nice twist that, perhaps he was good all along and just forced to do what he had to do in the Resurrection of the Dalek story, and was actually on the right side in this one.
Yeah.
I wasn't so convinced by Terry Molloy as playing Russell.
No, he was okay, but I don't think he's a particularly good actor. He's better under a mask, I think.
I think he's an excellent Davros.
Yeah, he's an excellent.
He's not a very good Russell, though, I don't think. No. And I don't think for a minute he would have convinced anybody in the criminal fraternity that he was a criminal, no matter how he tried to cockney his voice up.
Yeah.
I thought he was unconvincing from the word go. So, but I mean, it's fairly obvious fairly quickly that he isn't a criminal. So I suppose it doesn't matter so much.
No. We talked a little bit about the violence in it. Just thinking about the things that happen in it. You get the Doctor beating up the policeman. You get him telling Perry to shoot Russell. You get the bit with Lytton's hands being crushed, which, is probably the most grotesque bit. You get that bit with Russell shooting the sideman in the point blank in the head. And then the Doctor sort of shooting everybody at the end as well, all the remaining sidemen at the end. It is more violent than most stories is. I mean, I know Vengeance of Barrowsaws gets the headlines as the violent story, doesn't it? But I think this is much more violent.
Yeah, it's more shocking.
Yeah, because when we did Barrows, the Doctor's often accused of like pushing the chap into the acid bath, isn't he, and killing somebody else, I think. But it's not actually, that isn't actually what happened, is it?
No, it isn't.
Whereas in this, it's clear that he likes a tussle. And he's got no qualms about, using a gun as well.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting one to do directly after Seat of Doom, isn't it, where Tom Baker's Doctor was punching people and neck-twisting and all sorts. But it somehow didn't seem quite so out of place, although it was surprising. The rest of his characterisation, carried it, I think.
Mm.
Whereas, because Colin Baker's Doctor is so unlikable. He's violent, unlikable, rather than Tom Baker's Doctor, who's occasionally violent, but very likable.
Mm.
I mean, it's a brave decision to make him a kind of anti-hero. It's like going back to the early days of Hartnell, isn't it? Plus violence, which is a brave thing to do. I don't think it works completely.
No, I don't think it does either.
But it's interesting that Colin Baker had a long-term plan, didn't he, to soften the Doctor as time went on. As it turned out, he didn't have as much time as he thought. By the end of what he expected the length of his tenure to be, maybe he would have been very likable, and all those kind of facets that we're seeing in this story would have gone or been softened to a point where they don't matter anymore.
That's right, and listening to the Big Finish audios, that's certainly what they've done with the Doctor's character in that.
Yes.
Colin Baker's Big Finish stuff is excellent. He's a much more likable Doctor than he ever was on the telly. It's a bit of a gamble to do that kind of thing, isn't it? To have a long-term plan of ending up being nice. but starting it being an unlikable character.
Yeah, it's making a lot of assumptions, isn't it? As it turned out, we'll never know how it would have been, but I suppose you get a hint from what Big Finish are doing. the basic idea of Cybermen stories, they feed on themselves, don't they, the Cybermen stories. It's so much harking back to what Cybermen have done in the past. You must have that in the story because that's what Cybermen do.
Yeah.
That you get a series of stories that aren't really that different to each other. Do you think?
I know what you're saying. Even more than the Daleks, they seem to, or the writers seem to have to kind of refer to what's gone before when there doesn't seem to be a need to do it, really. This one, more than any, you know, basically pulls everything from 10th Planet and Tomb, the Cybermen. And then you've got the other stuff, you know, like Resurrection of the Daleks with the litter. There's all sorts of continuity, and it's no wonder that the series was getting into bother with viewing figures at this kind of time when it puts the casual viewer off, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to tell from our standpoint what it would be like to watch that story not knowing any of the backstories of Lytton or the Cybermen. But we were struggling with the continuity and, you know, have a pretty decent knowledge of it. So it must just be incomprehensible to the first-time viewer.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, I mean, it is possible to tell a story with Cybermen and not have to do that, surely.
Well, you would think so, wouldn't you? But the whole searching for the time vessel thing, as I said, you know, was a subplot that was put in, you know, late on. I mean, the story without that would be, I know it doesn't come to anything, as it turns out. You know, they just end up getting killed when they get to the vessel, which is a little bit pointless, I suppose. But without that, I can't imagine what that story would have been like. You know, just dull, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would have been. Well, it's difficult to know what an earlier draft had. Obviously, it must have had something else in it to get them to tell us, you know, in the first place. But yeah, it's too convoluted. And, you know, because of that, it degenerates in the second episode from a good start, you know, in part one. You want them to see the next part to see how it's going to transpire. And then you think, at the end of it, you think, oh, God, I wish I hadn't bothered. So a mixed bag, I think it's fair to say.
Yes, a curate's egg, definitely. Shall we do a little bit of feedback?
Yeah, let's do a bit of feedback. So first up, we've got Wayne Peters, who says things that he learned whilst watching Attack of the Cybermen. Cyber controllers eat better than other Cybermen. Cyber hands are very powerful, but their heads are quite fragile.
True.
And the TARDIS state of grace appears to be temporarily disconnected, as does the Doctor's aversion to guns and violence. I quite enjoyed this, not as garish or irritating as I remember Colin Baker's tenure being, Perry and the Doctor's costume aside. Episode 1 felt more like an episode of The Sweeney, with a bunch of geezers doing a bank job and running around in a cortina. The fixed comedian circuit was a bit fun. I remember the tabloids kicking up a stink at the time. The BBC were getting rid of our police box. Glad they didn't, though. Nice idea tying the original destruction of Mondas in with the actual date it was meant to happen. It was nice to see Lytton again, even if the whole subplot to steal the time ship amounted to absolutely nothing and didn't seem to serve any purpose whatsoever. True. Not the best whoever, but not a bad one from a period I remember as being pretty consistently poor. Yeah, well, interesting points.
Yeah, that's very true. The thing about the chameleon circuit is interesting, isn't it? Because it turns out that it was a publicity stunt, wasn't it? They were never intended to stop the TARDIS being a police box, but they just wanted to create an episode to change around, which was good fun, I think.
Yeah,
that's the way it says. Yeah. On to Mike Wenburn. I just watched this on YouTube. I thought it was tripe. I always felt sorry for Colin Baker because I thought there was a good doctor there trying to get out. However, he was hamstrung by awful stories and shabby production values. Looking at this story, he had both in spades. The story was talky, lacking in any suspense, with threads that didn't amount to anything. The Kryons were the worst type of web planet camp monsters, with their funny voices and silly hand gestures all the time. Halley's Comet looked like Button Moon. To non-English viewers, Button Moon was a children's program about activities on the moon, which was really literally made out of washing up liquid bottles and stuff, and quite obviously so. The cyber controller looked like a fat old man. The ferocious explosive power of the coconut ice that the doctor was locked up with looked like an indoor firework. At the time, I thought it was so unjust, but looking at these mid to late 80s stories, now I'm amazed that the programme staggered on for as long as it did. I can't believe that anyone but a die-hard fan would know what the hell everyone was talking about when it came to the backstory, based as it was on stories that had been shown on TV once in the 60s and then destroyed or sent to Hong Kong. Why would they set out to alienate the audience? a bit of history is fine, but when the show is being made for the fans, then Joe Public stops watching. The only saving graces were Brian Casper, you little bastard, get in the shower, Glover, and the score by Malcolm Clark from Earthshock. That's a reference to Kes, isn't it? Brian Glover is brilliant as a sort of vile sports teacher in Kes. Mike finishes with a poor, very poor, I would feel ill-used if I bought the DVD.
Yes, a bit more damning than our thoughts, I think. Okay, next up, Mike Doyle, who says, getting ready to watch Colin Baker, you get those normal feelings, trepidation, the need for sunglasses, and paracetamol at the ready. So what did the story give us? The knowledge that the Doctor's costume cannot be improved by the addition of a policeman's helmet. The repair of the chameleon circuit appears to have been there only as a reason for some apparent comic relief. Brian Glover was good as usual, but as a henchman does not appear to be the smartest tool in the box. Come on, show some reaction when your boss announces that he's actually an alien and is offering you as a gift to a gaggle of Cybermen.
that's true. He just stands there and accepts it, doesn't he?
Yeah, but then I think he was supposed to be somebody that wasn't all there, as Lytton constantly takes the piss out of him.
Yeah, he's a little bit challenged in that department.
Mm. Speaking of the Cybermen, they really need to check their warranty on their neck couplings. It appears that just the addition of a scarf may offer more protection. Their heads appear to fall off in a slight breeze. Is there an election for the Cyber Controller, and this year they gave it to an apparent Mohican-wearing chubbo with poor posture? The Kryons appear a very tactile race and a lawsuit awaiting to happen. Stop invading my personal space. So production values are getting poorer, stories more reliant on Who knowledge, and Perry's clothes are getting tighter. Yes, that was the mid-80s.
Very much so. Yeah. In a nutshell.
Nice one, Mike.
Yeah, cheers. My brother, Rob, was quite keen to offer some feedback on this one, because it's one of his favourites. He thinks the first episode is a good mixture of atmosphere and action, with its claustrophobic tunnels and location filming in London. The second episode moves to the planet Telos and introduces the Kryons, both of which are quite convincingly alien. The story is, on the whole, good, with a few interesting twists to keep the viewer guessing and provide some surprises. There's plenty of violence and a lot of deaths, which seems to be part of the formula for that era of Doctor Who. It certainly is. It seems to be, as I say, the production team's policy was to make it more violent. Plus points, Colin Baker's on good form in the story, and there are two other strong characters leading their components of the story, Commander Lytton and Bates. The script is good, with a few pithy one-liners for the Doctor and Lytton, such as he's having a little lie down when the Doctor knocks out the fake policeman. Brian Glover's Griffiths gives a little comic relief during his meeting with the Cyber Controller with his getting a bit rough, is it, robotic voice. Minus points, the incidental music works well in some scenes, enhancing the atmosphere, but it seems childish and out of place in most other scenes. But that's my point. You know, I think a lot of the sort of London scenes are literally ruined by that.
I don't think so.
Yeah, you don't feel strongly, do you? Rob goes on to say the cryogenic capsules on Telos seem much inferior to the ones seen in Tomb of the Cybermen. They appear to have 1960s council house front doors on rooms that are far too big for storing a single frozen Cyberman. That is true. They're like little, in London you call them a studio flat, wouldn't you? His general comments are, I didn't see very many of the Colin Baker stories when they were first shown, but I've seen most of them when they repeat on UK Gold. Attack of the Cybermen is definitely my favourite Colin Baker story, followed by Revelation of the Daleks. It's easy to be unkind about Colin Baker's portrayal of the Doctor, but this story shows that given a good script, you can be a good Doctor. Well, you disagree with that, don't you?
Well, I disagree with both parts of it, really.
I've listened to many of the Big Finish audio adventures of Doctor Who, and Colin Baker is easily my favourite Doctor in that medium.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, definitely.
Yeah, quite a few people believe that, don't they? And he ends with, is it just me, or did anyone else think that Terry Molloy looked a bit like Tim Brooke Taylor out of the goodies? He does very much so, particularly as he looks now.
Yeah.
And so, thanks to Rob and everyone else for the feedback there. Most of that, apart from Rob's, all of that feedback can be found on our Facebook page. A little bit of feedback from T.O. Dimov on our Facebook wall. He says of the story, I love it, my favourite Colin Baker story. There's another nice point from Mike Doyle. Just watch the first episode. The strangest thing is, in the first 2 minutes, just as you're thinking those sewage workers should really be wearing high visibility jackets, we cut to the interior of the TARDIS and the most visible jacket ever seen on British television. So there's, at least a couple of people there who like this one better than any other of Colin Baker's reign.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's obviously a story that divides opinion, isn't it? Some people like it, a lot of people don't, so. Yeah. Mm. So that's all the feedback for this story. Thanks everybody for giving us that, and keep it coming. We'd love to see what other people think about it.
Yes, indeedy. You can get in contact with us via our Facebook page. You can just go into your Facebook account and look up Crinoid, or you can go to our blog page where you can also contact us at crinoid.blog.co.uk. There's a link to our Facebook page on there as well in the top left-hand corner. You can follow and or tweet us on Twitter. We are at Crinoid. And if you just want to email us directly, we're crinoid@mail.com. So plenty of ways to get in contact, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Good stuff. So I suppose we better rate it then.
Yes. You go first.
You want me to go first? I keep changing my mind on this one.
Me too, actually. That's why I wanted you to go first.
Okay. Well, I'm going to have to give it a 6, I think. I gave it a 7, then I thought 7's too much, it's a 6. For all the reasons we've given, the poor plotting, the over-convoluted plotting, I should say. Colin Baker's performance just jarred for me, and although it did have some good points in it, and it is reasonably enjoyable to watch, the first episode especially, but overall, I really think it's a bit of a mess, so 6.
Yeah, I had exactly the same thoughts, but boringly enough about it, I was flitting between a 7 and a 6. It's one of those things that when I kind of think of the Colin Baker era, this one I tend to think of quite fondly.
Mm.
But having watched it again for the podcast, perhaps I've just taken the good bits for granted this time and just concentrated on the negative. But it's a great first episode. I think I'm less annoyed by Colin Baker's portrayal than you seem to be. I think he's better than he was, and I think he's hitting his stride. But for the other reasons that we've mentioned, it has good points and poor points. I don't think I'll give it as much as a 7, so I'll give it a 6.
Mm. Okay. Right. So what are we going to do next time?
A good question.
I think it's my choice. So we are going to go for a Peter Davison story.
Oh.
That story is going to be Enlightenment.
Aha.
Yes. So that's what we're going to be talking about next time. Although before that podcast is broadcast, I would think that we're going to do another mini one for the Christmas special, A Christmas Carol.
Yes, we are indeed. That will come out sometime early January, we hope. Hopefully the first week of January. What do you think of it from what you've seen of the pre-publicity?
I don't know. To be perfectly honest with you, I'm not particularly looking forward to it because I think it's going to be a bit cheesy and I don't know. I'm hoping that they'll prove me wrong and that it'll be the first Christmas special that I've actually enjoyed. But on past Christmas specials, based on those, I'm not holding my breath.
I know exactly what you mean, that the Christmas specials are, in my opinion, never that good. I have higher hopes for this one just because Russell T. Davis isn't involved. And, and I like what the current production team and Doctor have been doing. I'm also a bit of a sucker for the Christmas Carol story, so I'm interested to see how they're going to twist it and make it work for Doctor Who. So I'm quietly optimistic, but... Yes, my hopes have been dashed so many times by Christmas specials that it remains to be seen.
Yeah. I just think that Christmas Carol has been done by every single programme that could possibly do a version of it. There's been a Blackadder one, there's been a Catherine Tate did one, all sorts of programmes have done versions of it.
Yeah, they have, and plenty of versions of the original story as well.
Yeah, exactly. When I first heard it, that's what it was called. And that's what it's going to be about, and my heart sunk, really.
I actually felt slightly better, because at the end of Series 5, they were talking about the Orient Express in space, weren't they? Which, to me, just sounded like that awful Titanic Christmas episode. And it looks like it isn't going to have much to do with that. Or if it is, it isn't going to be as bad as it sounds.
Yeah.
So, my spirits were raised by the Christmas Carol reference, but let's see what happens. I'm pleased to hear that, although Catherine Jenkins is extremely easy on the eye, I was a little bit surprised that she was cast in an acting role, but it turns out she's singing as well, which perhaps justifies why they chose her, but makes you slightly worried as what the musical content is going to be.
Yes, making it worse, Jim.
I don't look forward to seeing Applecheek, Victorian Urchins singing Consider Yourself, dancing around the TARDIS, but I'm hoping that's not going to happen.
Oh, well, we shall soon see, won't we?
6 o'clock Christmas Day, isn't it, I believe?
I believe so.
In the UK.
So we'll look forward to that and to talking about it. And then at some point in January, we should be looking at Enlightenment as well. So
yeah, give us your thoughts on the Christmas special once you've seen it, and your thoughts on Enlightenment. And we'll be delighted to read them and include them in the podcast where appropriate.
We should just say as well that after Enlightenment, we will be returning to some of your suggestions that you've put in, so look out for those later in the year. And if you do have some more suggestions for stories that you'd like us to review, then give us your thoughts at Facebook page. There's a discussion board there for you to put your suggestions down, so please do that.
Yes, please. And we should say at this juncture of the year, thanks ever so much for listening to us all year.
Yes, thanks very much. And on that note, we shall leave you, and we'll talk to you again in the new year.
Yeah, so happy Christmas and a happy new year. And we hope to have your company in our next podcast in the beginning of 2011, would you believe?
Yes, I would, because that's next year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's fairly obvious then, really.
Bye, then.
Bye.
I don't think I've ever misjudged anybody quite as badly as I did Lytton.